Good evening, everyone, and welcome back to the third episode of FRCS Eurocast. I'm Harry Ratter, neurologist from Nottingham, and as ever, I've got my wonderful co-host, Sophia Cashman. Good evening, Sophia.
Hi, Harry. I'm Sophia Cashman. I'm a registrar in the East of England, still.
Still,
another couple of months.
Not much longer, because Sophia's coming to work with us in Nottingham. We're all super excited. Since we first started recording these, we've published a couple of episodes now, haven't we? And I think it's fair to say that the response has been amazingly positive. I was quite surprised.
Yeah, it was really good. I've had some really lovely feedback from a lot of people that have said that it's filling a bit of a gap for them and helping them use some like time in the car, etc., to revise, which is the goal. Also a few people that are using it just for a bit of an update, which is quite nice. So hopefully we're updating sufficiently.
Today we're tackling a subject which I think a lot of us felt quite nervous about coming up to the exam, and it's prostate cancer. In general terms, prostate cancer probably gets more attention than any other urological condition, both in terms of research funding and studies, and you know, you're expected to know quite a lot. So I think it can seem to be quite an intimidating topic to talk about in an exam. What do you think, Sophia?
Yeah, I think it was definitely my least favourite thing to kind of revise for the exam, mainly because, as you said, there's so much research. I felt that by the time I'd read the end of the guidelines, I'd kind of started rewriting them. And I think you can get in a bit of a minefield, like in terms of all of the different evidence just for the diagnostic pathway, let alone when you've actually found it. So I think it's something that we need to kind of put a bit of effort into trying to clarify.
Yeah, so obviously tonight we'll be doing a few podcasts on prostate cancer at various points, but we thought we'd get the ball rolling today by looking at someone diagnosed with localized prostate cancer. And very excitingly, once again, we've got another special guest. So we had Will Green talking about bladder cancer last time, but we've got someone even more clever and fabulous. So I'd like to welcome Flora Rodger. Many of you will know Flora because she is an ST7 trainee up in Glasgow. And, you know, I'm feeling quite thick at the moment because Flora, along with you, Sophia, is the recipient of the Keith Yates Medal for the FRCS. I'm surrounded by gold medal winners. So welcome, Flora. It's lovely to have you on.
Hi, thanks for the very welcome introduction there. I'm not sure that it's necessarily that valid, but thanks very much. So yeah, here to chat to you about prostate cancer today and hopefully convince you that it's not as daunting a topic as some people think it is.
So in standard exam style, we thought we'd focus on a case. So Flora, we've got a 52-year-old man. He's fit and well and was referred to his GP referred by his GP with a routine blood test showing a PSA of 7.6. He's already been through your local prostate diagnostic service. He's had an MRI, which showed a 42-gram prostate with a PIRADS-4 lesion on the right-hand side. No concerning features, no nodes or extra capsular extension. He's already had a local anaesthetic TP biopsy, which confirmed Gleason 4 plus 3 prostate cancer in 2 of the 8 cores they took at the right, and they were labelled as the target specimen. And he's also been found to have Gleason 3 plus 3 in 2 of 6 cores on the left, which was labelled as left mid. The remainder of biopsies were benign. So how would you go about approaching a patient like this?
So yeah, we've got a kind of typical history there of a patient with localized prostate cancer. And I guess for those listening to this podcast from the point of view of the exam, it's important to listen out for certain things like hearing this gentleman's fit and well. So you don't need to waste time asking about past medical history, just take the information that you're given. So when you're thinking about how to treat patients with localized prostate cancer, that's one of the main things that we need to think about is, you know, who is radical treatment for prostate cancer actually for? And it's for patients who are going to survive for at least 10 years following the treatment for them to actually derive some benefit from it. So if you've got a patient with multiple comorbidities, it's not going to be not necessarily going to be an option. making those decisions about patient fitness in the clinic can sometimes feel quite daunting, I think, and it's useful to have some tools and guidance for that. So there are tools such as the Charlson Comorbidity Index, and there's a kind of list of key conditions there that if you have less than two of those conditions, your chance of being alive at 10 years is fairly high. You would be suitable for radical treatment, and that's endorsed by the EAU guidelines. Age in prostate cancer is definitely not a cutoff as such. You know, this gentleman's younger, but if you had patients getting getting into the kind of older age range, maybe over 70, then you start to wonder about the kind of appropriateness of treatment. So for patients that are over 70, there are additional tools like Geriatric Assessment 8 tool, which can be used. And there's a kind of scoring system you can go through there. And if they have a score of over 14, then they have a good chance of being able to derive benefit from radical treatments. If we've decided this patient is appropriate for radical treatment, which I think we have, a young gentleman with localized prostate cancer, then we need to think about what the options are. And there are quite a few, three key ones, really. So we have active surveillance, surgery with a radical prostatectomy, or radiotherapy. And then there are some additional treatments, things like brachytherapy or focal therapies. These are done much less commonly. Brachytherapy, I'll touch on later perhaps, has got kind of a narrow set of kind of indications and quite a few kind of contraindications which limit its use. And focal therapies, although there is some good emerging data from some key centres looking at things like cryo and HIFU, NICE haven't actually endorsed this out with the trial setting currently, and that's probably due to the lack of long-term replicable data.
So all of the focals currently, they're still done under trial settings, are they?
Yeah, that's that's as per the most up-to-date NICE guidelines on prostate cancer.
Yeah, it's quite a good place set of
recently,
as well,
Flora,
wasn't it?
The NICE guidelines.
Let me tell you the year. I think they're 2021.
I think it was 21.
Yeah, 21.
Yeah, so quite recently updated. And yeah, I mean, Flora, coming back to our particular case then, I think Sophia presented the histopathological findings from the biopsy. How would you kind of drill into those a little bit to perhaps kind of risk stratify this chap?
So, when we talk about risk stratification, looking at the grading is one important factor. Also looking at the PSA and the radiological T stage. So as you were saying that things change from by the time you start reading it to the end, something's changed. So when I did my exam, which was not very long ago, we were still using the D'Amico low and intermediate and high risk stages or risk stratification tables. And that was looking at your PSA being less than 10 or greater than 20 to split into the three groups. And based on your T stage of T1, T2 and greater than T2. Now we've moved towards the Cambridge prognostic groups, which I think has actually been quite useful. So it's not just a change just for the sake of making exam sitters have a more challenging time. It actually picks out some quite important differences of kind of heterogeneity within those three groups that we were initially using. So it kind of identifies out CPG1, so the absolute lowest risk group. And those patients are patients that really, unless there's a particular other reason, should be mainly going towards active surveillance. And any kind of invasive treatments for them would be largely viewed as over-treatment. That's something that can then be picked out through things like the National Prostate Cancer Audit. And similarly, in the high risk group, it manages to pick out very, very high risk CPG5 patients that may have slightly different risk of biochemical recurrence and things like that in the long run compared to CPG4.
So this CPG grouping really gives you a bit more nuance to the three criteria and pulls apart that intermediate group slightly more.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's not just for the sake of making people's lives complicated, it does actually pull out some interesting interesting differences in the groups.
And the EAU still talk about ISUP, don't they?
They do.
Which, again, that's kind of pulling apart the middle group, isn't it? Just kind of separating out threes and fours and threes.
Yeah, and I think there are some important differences there based on what treatments patients then go on to have and their risk of recurrence and things following that.
Mm-hmm.
And so you did ask me about the biopsy as well. So his biopsy was a targeted biopsy on one side, which was the 4+3 area, just 2 out of 8 cores. and on the other side 3+3. So essentially the 3+3 areas is not being visualized on MRI, so it is a sort of incidental finding of low-grade disease. It's quite easy in these prediction tools or scoring systems to end up actually counting those biopsies as maybe more pathogenic than they necessarily are. So you just need to be a little bit mindful of that. And yeah, this patient, although they do have some 4+3, it's only actually in 2 cores out of 8 from a small target. So all options would probably still be open to this gentleman.
Yeah, great. So you mentioned active surveillance. Would that be an option, or who's that an option for?
So yeah, active surveillance, I think we're very comfortable treating patients in CPG1 and CPG2 with active surveillance, but actually if you look at the NICE guidelines, it is recommended for discussion for patients in CPG1 to 3. So it needs to be for, you know, highly selected patients that are going to be compliant with an active surveillance protocol and follow-up. But it's a really useful strategy for patients that are keen to avoid side effects of radical treatment, particularly in those that have low-grade disease or low-risk disease, and potentially the side effects of treatment may be worse for patients than a period of surveillance.
There are lots of active surveillance protocols out there, Flora. I understand that one of the biggest groups which studied this was Laurie Klotz's group in Toronto. Is that right? So many people do follow a kind of a similar protocol. Is that correct?
Yeah, so there's a lot of kind of heterogeneity in what's meant by active surveillance across, you know, across studies. And at the moment, I think in the UK, there's not necessarily an agreement as such on an active surveillance strategy, but there is a recommended approach in the NICE guideline. And that would involve an MRI and biopsy at initiation to kind of enter into your phase of active surveillance, and then 4 monthly PSAs with a DRE and MRI at 12 to 18 months. There's not any routine biopsy recommended as part of the NICE active surveillance protocol. And actually beyond year 2, there's not even any routine MRI recommended as part of it. So it's just 6 monthly PSAs and an annual DRE. I think most people would monitor their patient's PSA, and they would get a biopsy or an MRI if they had any concern about PSA progression or stage progression on examination.
How long do you follow them up for? Presumably until their life expectancy is shorter than 10 years, i.e. even if they progressed, you perhaps wouldn't treat them actively. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think so. I think at every stage with active surveillance, there needs to be an assessment of the patient's, you know, a holistic approach to the patient's care and looking at their comorbidity status and reassessing those Charlson comorbidity figures again. And if a patient reaches the point that they wouldn't be deriving a benefit from radical treatment, then they should be moving from a strategy of active surveillance to a strategy of watchful waiting, which has obviously got slightly different implications.
So there was, I think it's in press, I saw it the other day, there's been a best practice publication from in European Urology Oncology, I think, which was a consensus statement about active surveillance protocols, which is really useful because obviously it's quite variable, but this is a big international consensus statement, so that paper is well worth a read. Caroline Moore et al. I think it's in press at the moment.
Oh, brilliant! So it's one to look out for coming up to the exam.
Yeah, exactly. And that kind of advocates high quality MRIs, and so I think it says that you could avoid rectal exams if you're doing MRIs. And again, if standard PSAs and MRIs, then you don't necessarily need to standardly biopsy patients.
Yeah.
And they talk about a kind of dynamic risk approach, because again, the active surveillance cohort is going to be quite heterogeneous. So they talk about looking at that. And I think there's been some suggested ways of stratifying down the different groups in active surveillance and then individualizing their follow up.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting area for research. There's a lot of patients that are on these active surveillance strategies, and it doesn't make sense to have people on varying schemes. It does make sense to have everyone on something where there's a consensus. So I guess other paper that you mentioned, which although now is, you know, not a very recent paper, is the Klotz database of 1,000 patients of low and intermediate risk disease who went on to a strategy of active surveillance. And I guess the key figures from that would be the There was a 99% survival at 10 years, 2.8% risk of metastatic disease at the end of their study period. And the most kind of key figure, which I always mention to patients, is that a third of patients had come off of active surveillance and opted for an invasive treatment by 10 years. Patients sometimes get a bit worried about the concept of surveillance and think that they're not having treatment, but actually, you know, it is just a delay to treatment and treating at the appropriate time.
Is it worth mentioning, I think in the EAU they mentioned variant histology, is it cribriform and intraductal should be excluded from active surveillance, is that right?
Yeah, I think there are a few kind of things like that where people get a bit more uncomfortable, and you know, there are the CPG risk, you know, criteria, but there are some additional factors which do make things slightly higher risk, and we'll maybe touch on that a little bit from some of the data from the PROTEC trial as well.
Great. Speaking of which.
Yeah, I guess this is something which is always going to be part of this talk and definitely needs to be brushed up on for the exam, and that is the PROTEC study. Study of 1,600 patients that were randomised into three groups of the radical treatments, so prostatectomy, radiotherapy and active monitoring. And I purposefully say monitoring and not surveillance, and that's because of what we've just discussed. There wasn't an agreed protocol of surveillance. There wasn't you know, recurrent biopsy or MRI performed in those patients. So so I purposefully say monitoring.
Mm-hmm. And I guess it's a very different back then, because that was conducted back in the early 2000s, wasn't it? It was certainly recruited to then. And in fact, when I was working in Leicester as a registrar, as a research fellow, we were biopsying patients as part of the PROTECT trial. And certainly there wasn't MRI as a tool then. So, I mean, how applicable do you think PROTECT is to the patients that we see nowadays?
Yes, I guess it's a very changed landscape now with MRI, which is, you know, such a major part of the prostate cancer diagnostic pathway and active surveillance pathway. I think there are some key lessons, certainly, with the PROTEC trial, and the most important kind of take-home message of it, which it needs to be emphasised to patients, is that cancer-specific survival and overall survival in all three treatments was equal at 10 years. Sometimes quite difficult to kind of get that information across to patients, is that they quite often think that having something done, you know, having cancer removed inherently is going to be safer for them than other treatments. And this, you know, this study showed that is not the case.
Was there a difference in progression in the groups?
The other kind of point to make here is that actually in the active monitoring group, patients were twice as likely to progress to metastatic disease, although those numbers are low. So it was progression going from 2.6% to 6%. So it remains low, but certainly, you know, a noticeable difference between the groups there.
And that fits with what the NICE guidelines state, because for distance met, I think for active surveillance, they say 8 in every 100, whereas radical radiotherapy and robotic prostatectomy are 3 in every 100, I think.
Yeah, that just touches on the NICE guideline again, and one really, really important table within the NICE guideline, which actually takes you through figures that you've just described that are represented visually as well. So it can be a really, really useful document to go through as you're counselling a patient, and certainly if you're practising counselling a patient for the purpose of the exam. So it's definitely worth having a look at that table. And not only does it give you about their risk of progression, but also things like side effects of the individual treatments as well.
So our patient would be a candidate for active surveillance, but being CPG-3, it would be a consider, wouldn't it, rather than
Yeah, absolutely, advice. Absolutely. I think locally we do get kind of more jumpy about 4+3s, and I'm sure that's probably felt elsewhere in the country as well. You know, he has a slightly higher risk patient because of that. It's only in 2 cores out of 8 from the target, so it is a small focus, and obviously it's a kind of quick vignette, but it doesn't give us any additional information from the biopsy about core length or presence of perineural invasion and things like that, which may slightly guide you one way or the other. Certainly if this, you know, if there was a high percentage or core length, and it might make you more kind of concerned about the option of surveillance for him.
So what would his other options be?
So yeah, the other options then being surgery or radiotherapy. So as a surgeon, I would obviously like to talk to you about surgery first.
In a completely non-biased way, exactly. Of course, yeah.
So yeah, as I say, before having any of these discussions with patients, I always really, really emphasise the fact that, you know, they've come to a surgical clinic to talk about surgery, but that is in the context of the data that we have in the PROTECT trial. So a radical prostatectomy then, an operation probably most of us have seen as we go through training, removing the prostate, the capsule and seminal vesicles. It's not as simple as it sounds, I guess. And a lot of the time when patients come to see you in a surgical clinic, the first thing that you have to do is actually make sense of whether prostatectomy is appropriate for that patient, whether it's actually safe for them. So, you know, patients have to be in a Trendelenburg position of 30 degrees to have this done. So there are some precluding conditions, things like untreated glaucoma, even mild degrees of aortic stenosis can make it very challenging. Any issues with intracranial pressure or anything like that would certainly be a concern. And just BMI is a key kind of figure as well. So if you've got a lot of central adiposity and you get into a Trendelenburg position, it can have quite a lot of knock-on effects for ventilation. Your anaesthetist is not going to be very happy if you've listed somebody with a very high BMI. So yeah, I mean, the way that I've seen this done most is a transperitoneal approach. So you do need to think about things like patients having previous surgery. Are they going to have lots of adhesions or hostile abdomen due to other conditions like bowel surgery or bad bouts of diverticulitis? Although there are some other ways to do this by extraperitoneal approach. And actually, I was on a webinar the other day from EAU where they were talking to us about the single port da Vinci robot, which they're now able to do prostatectomy transvesically, which means that they don't have to expose the abdomen to any pneumoperitoneum. So really good for day case prostatectomy, although just starting in a few centres in Europe, and I guess we'll see what we get out of that data wise in the future.
We always talk about robotic prostatectomy. Is there any evidence that it's better than laparoscopic or open?
So there is evidence to say that robotic prostatectomy has got less rates of blood transfusion. Uh-huh. And certainly I think we can all agree as a urological fraternity, I shouldn't say fraternity as a woman, but you know, it is certainly where we want to go. Open prostatectomy, you know, did have good evidence for it, certainly, yeah. But it's a more morbid operation for patients, longer hospital stay, more risk of blood transfusion. I think that evidence is borne out.
Great. And what when you're counselling them, when you're talking about complications, do you have any kind of key stats that you quote?
So that you can get all your stats on complications and things from the BAUS consent form, certainly. Mm-hmm. And there are some fairly key potential risks and complications with prostatectomy that need to be mentioned. The main ones being obviously risk of erectile dysfunction and risk of incontinence. Mm-hmm. Obviously there are other, you know, more generic risks and side effects, so things like bleeding, infection, mortality, rectal injury, anastomotic leak, stenosis, you know, injury to bowel or ureters that might need drains or stents. Other kind of more unusual things that you need to think about for patients. So this guy's 52, but it is worth asking patients about what their, you know, their family situation is, because obviously after an operation like this, they are going to be infertile. And we do quite frequently send patients for sperm banking just if it's appropriate for them. And things like penile shortening, stitches that you put in the DVC, dorsal venous complex, can lead to some shortening of the penis, and if patients are not expecting that, they're not going to be happy. And other things like orgasmic dysfunction, and I think these sorts of side effects are under investigated and probably underreported. And then, you know, going forward, longer term side effects like biochemical recurrence and need for salvage treatments.
So when you're talking about erectile dysfunction, who gets a nerve spare and how much does that help?
Yeah, so nerve sparing is only suitable for certain selected patients, but certainly can improve the rates of erectile dysfunction and IEF scores after an operation. So what's really the most important factor when you're talking to these patients is finding out what their pre-op IEF score is and what their erections are like beforehand, because certainly all patients are going to notice some negative impact, and certainly things are not going to get any better than they currently are. So that needs to be documented and discussed before an operation. If you can have a unilateral nerve spare, there are studies to say that you can be 50% potent, which can be then increased to 60% if you're able to have a bilateral nerve spare. So it is effective, but it, as I say, it's not suitable for all patients. So things like palpable disease or extraprostatic extension or very high grade disease on one side may preclude you from doing it on one side.
Who would you consider doing lymph node dissections on, Flora?
So lymph node dissection is a tricky question, I think, and there's kind of lots of studies looking at that. But the main take-home message with lymph node dissection is there is no survival benefit attributed to lymph node dissection. There are kind of ongoing studies, they're recruiting an MSKCC to one randomising patients for lymph node dissection, and we'll see if we get any interesting data from that. But essentially, the purpose of doing a lymph node dissection is for complete staging information, so it's not going to actually improve your overall survival or biochemical recurrence rate going forward. So the risks of a lymph node dissection are things like slightly longer procedure, maybe adds about 40 minutes to the procedure, so it's slight increased risk of DVT and PE, increased risk of a lymphocele, of leg and groin swelling, slight increased risk of need for a drain after an operation if you get an infected lymphocele. So it's not for all patients, and certainly low-risk patients shouldn't be offered a lymph node dissection, because the risk of a lymph dissection outweighs in any benefit that they would gain from that staging information. So we use things like the Briganti scoring, or there's an MSKCC score which can be used, and you basically plug in the data about their age, their PSA, their number of positive cores. I think the MSKCC score also asks you the diameter of the tumour on the MRI scan as well. And generally, we offer it to patients where there's a risk of lymph node involvement over about 6%.
As a very quick segue, adjuvant treatment. Am I right in thinking radicals has ruled out adjuvant radiotherapy?
Yeah, absolutely. So the radicals study looked at radiotherapy following a prostatectomy and showed no survival benefit with that. And it did also lead to, you know, worse continence outcomes. So so that's now not offered as a standard treatment. And similarly, the use of hormones in the adjuvant, neoadjuvant setting, that has been looked at. And there is some sort of anecdotal evidence surgically that it can make the neoadjuvant hormones can make the prostatectomy more challenging, can kind of interrupt the planes. And some studies have actually shown that it can reduce your positive margin rate and biochemical recurrence, but actually this doesn't then translate into any change in cancer specific or overall survival. So it's not something that's currently recommended. Although in the era of abiraterone and enzalutamide and other hormone therapies, it's probably something that will be looked at again, I'm sure.
Good. And speaking of radiotherapy, should we go on to talk about the role of that treatment?
So, yeah, certainly the way our prostate clinics are set up is we would see them from a surgical point of view, and we would make a point of patients all then seeing clinical oncologists to discuss radiotherapy, and then you get a more kind of accurate and honest picture from the person that's actually delivering the treatment. So I'm slightly veering off of my usual chat here, but to touch on radiotherapy then, essentially again, the take-home message being that it's got the same overall survival figures as a prostatectomy or active surveillance at 10 years. Patients often get concerned about bowel side effects. Again, the figures for that are very nicely laid out in the NICE guidelines. And actually, the rates of bowel side effects or significant bowel side effects like fecal incontinence are actually low. And I think quite often overstated by patients sometimes. They're very, very concerned about the possibility of it, but actually the rates are something like in the region of about 5%, so 95% of not having that. Obviously, there are certain patients that are at higher risk. Modern radiotherapy as well is slightly different than the radiotherapy that we are now all seeing the complications of. So if you think of, the radiation cystitis patient that you take to theatre for a washout and they have an acrid bladder, they've had a different type of radiotherapy, 10 or 20 years ago than is currently offered. So currently it's intensity modulated radiotherapy, which uses anatomical targeting and collimation to try and reduce the fallout of radiation to healthy tissues around the prostate. And that's been shown to have low rates of biochemical recurrence, lower than traditional radiotherapy, but actually have less GU side effects. There is also evidence for dose escalation, which can improve the rates of biochemical recurrence, and that can be done safely without actually altering the rates of side effects.
Key study for radiotherapy, is it the CHIP study?
Yeah, I think so. So the CHIP study particularly is looking at the issue of hyperfractionation. Mm-hmm. And hyperfractionation is a clever tool that the clinical oncologists use, looking at the rate of growth of prostate cancer cells. So prostate cancer cells grow slowly, which means that they have a higher sensitivity to high doses of radiation per fraction. And that's due to something called your alpha-beta ratio, which is worth looking up for the exam. So the CHIP study essentially showed that 60...
That right there is why you won the gold medal, Flora.
Maybe for the part one, I don't know. The CHIP study, showed that 60 grays per 20 fractions was effective as compared to the traditional, 74 and 37 fractions. So there was no increased biochemical recurrence. It's more convenient for patients because they have to come along on less days. And it's obviously cost effective because patients are having to come to hospital less frequently. And data from the National Prostate Cancer Audit have shown no significant differences in GU or bowel side effects with that.
And what about hormones with radiotherapy?
So yeah, as you'll probably have heard through your MDTs, these patients are all getting hormones as well as their radiotherapy. So currently NICE recommends that they should have 6 months of neoadjuvant hormones and then 3 years of adjuvant hormones following their treatment. And that is based on kind of pivotal studies from URTC by Bola that showed improved disease-free survival at 10 years with 3 years of adjuvant hormones, and similar data from the PR07 study.
Can we do a brief overview of BRCA?
Yeah, so I think BRCA we'll touch on just very quickly because, as I say, it is used, you know, much less frequently than the other treatments. And that is largely because it's got a very narrow kind of indication range. So you need to have a prostate that's less than 30 cc's, ideally maybe a prostate with no median lobe, have an IPSS of less than 12, a Qmax over 15. So at this point, you're thinking, do we know any patient with prostate cancer that has these?
Yeah. That's hardly anyone, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And it's only for, you know, CPG 2 and 3 patients, certainly not for CPG 4 and 5. So it's not very commonly used. It involves the insertion of iodine seeds, which are radioactive, into the prostate. And they treat the prostate with radiotherapy in that way. It can be used in the BRCA boost setting, which is where it's used in conjunction with radiotherapy, or it can be used alone. And the kind of traditional brachytherapy that I've described there is something called low-dose brachytherapy. And that does have some radiation protection issues for patients' families because they do have ongoing radiation in the prostate. High-dose brachytherapy is a slightly different thing where they insert some iridium needles, and that's just a temporary thing. And as soon as the treatment is done on that day, all the kind of radioactive material is removed from the patient, so it doesn't have the same radiation protection issues for family. But although that is something that I have read about for exams and things, it's not something that I've seen locally. I don't know if either of you have a different experience.
No, I've not come across patients that have had HDR brachy either. I think brachy is something that certainly was seen as very promising, again, when I was a registrar 20 years ago, but it does seem to have fallen out of favour. And the other thing that I have had some experience of is HIFU, Flora. So that is something that's still done, but I understand it's just in the context of clinical trials at the moment. Is that right?
Yeah, HIFU and cryotherapy as well. There are good centres publishing data on this that show it to be effective in selected patients. The issue just being that we don't have large-scale studies with long-term data, and you know, when and if we do, I'm sure we'll make it into the NICE guideline out with the trial setting.
So for our final couple of minutes, so you've gone through the options comprehensively, but how would you help the patient make a decision on what to do?
So yeah, I think that the most important thing is that you ascertain what's safe for the patient. So patient choice is obviously vital, but we shouldn't be offering, you know, treatments as equal if one of them is actually not safe for the patient. So there are some conditions and things that a patient may have that may make one treatment an obvious choice over another. So things like if you've got a history of irritable bowel disease, so ulcerative colitis or Crohn's, it may be that you would be at risk of worse GU side effects from things like radiation. if you've already had previous radiotherapy for something else as well, then you're not going to be suitable for radiotherapy. So for those patients, you might have narrowed your field down to active surveillance or surgery. Similarly, if you've got patients that have got conditions that preclude them from having surgery, so you know, marked obesity, cardiovascular, respiratory conditions that make a general anaesthetic risky, then certainly radiotherapy is a safe option for those patients over surgery. Other kind of disease factors might guide you. So patients with CpG1, as I say, should really be encouraged to consider active surveillance because the side effects that they could get from other treatments really may not be warranted. And we just need to emphasise to those patients that if or when the risk of side effects became warranted because of signs of disease progression, then they would certainly be appropriate for that.
Are there any decision tools you use?
Yeah, so I've popped this guy's data from the kind of stem that we had there into the Predict Prostate tool, which I'd recommend to anyone to have a look at, you know, both with the exam and actually just when you're counselling patients. It's something that they can access themselves online, so you don't need to give them all this information in your clinic appointment and then they don't have the information again. They can go away and look at it in their own time. They can look at it after they've had your conversation, after they've had the conversation with their radiotherapist. So it can be really, really useful. It gives you the information in lots of different forms, so you can have it in charts where you've kind of got a bar chart, or you can have it in icons of 100 men, and then, you know, it highlights this is how many men would get disease progression, this is how many men would get certain side effects. And so those kind of visual representations can be really useful for patients to make their decisions. So I would certainly guide anyone to that. So this chap then, just I guess to look at his data, so he would have a 26% chance of erectile dysfunction after 6 years with conservative management, so active surveillance. So it's useful just to keep in mind for patients that the risk of, you know, side effects that we call them, erectile dysfunction, incontinence, the risk of these things in active surveillance isn't zero. These are still, you know, men of a certain age with prostate issues, and most of them have been picked up as having really a lot of the time incidental prostate cancer that's actually developed because of BPH symptoms. So they're still potentially going to have some of the side effects or some of the symptoms of those conditions. If he'd had a prostatectomy, he'll have a 50% chance of erectile dysfunction, and with radiotherapy, it's 39%. So I think, you know, patients will tell you, or will generally have an idea in their head of what is the most concerning side effect to them. And a lot of patients that I see just say, you know, you tell them about all these things and they say, oh, look, doc, I'm not interested about that, or I don't mind about this, I don't mind about that. And there'll be one issue that they're very, very concerned with. So, like, for example, saying about the bowel issues, I quite often get patients that come really, really fixed in their mind that they want to have surgery because of the concern about bowel issues. And actually for this gentleman, his risk of bloody stools half of the time or more frequently would be 6% with radiotherapy. So that means, you know, 94% chance that he's not going to have that severe bowel symptoms. And with the other treatments, obviously just less than 1% because they don't tend to lead to bowel symptoms. So I think it can be a really useful visual representation for patients and something they can peruse over time, because this isn't a decision that any patient should be making in the clinic room or, you know, under duress.
Well, thank you very much for that, Flora. That was really, really helpful. I think we've covered a huge amount of ground. And standard prostate cancer, there's still loads to do. But that definitely made a good start to it.
That's a fabulous overview, and it certainly ticked my box for prostate cancer CPD for the year. So thanks for that.
Very good.
Already feeling more intelligent just talking to you two. So thank you so much.
No problem.
So thanks again for joining us on this week's podcast. And my thanks go once again to Sophia and to Flora. And please do listen out for more episodes coming up in the very near future. Until then, take care, everyone, and good luck with your revision.